connect with and be ready for the Word of God in the Song of Solomon. Please turn to the first chapter, second verse. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. For your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. And the chorus. We rejoice and delight in you. We will praise your love more than wine. How right they are to adore you. Some love songs begin with a kind of simplicity and subtlety, but not this one. The horn section is at full volume and the timpani are pounding. Urgency contributes to some confusion in grammar, but the main point, the clear message of these opening verses is cannot be missed. The bride is head over heels in love with her man, and she wants him to gather her in his arms and take her to his bed. We know from the initial phrases of this song, of this poem, that it is about intimate experiences, both emotional, about intimate experiences and feelings of a husband and wife. This is a song about godly passion. And we'll discover this morning as we consider it that godly passion is honorable, is powerful, and is intoxicating. Let me say a couple of words about the text and kind of how we are going to read it, how it should, can be read. It is a series of speeches, poetic speeches made, and there are times when it's hard to know who's talking. There is no narrator. There is no one telling the story of this poem. There is just speeches either in dialogue or soliloquy, but we hear a person speak, and there are three voices making these speeches. There is a man's, a woman's, and the chorus. I'm going to use the term bride and groom to indicate the woman and the man, and then the word chorus to indicate this other group. As I said, occasionally commentators will differ over when one speech ends and the next begins, but we'll do our best to make it as clear for our purposes as we read through it this week and in the weeks to come. There are also descriptions of events and physical descriptions, images that are used, that are intended to convey feelings rather than content. We are told something that is supposed to help us understand the feeling of a thing rather than be given some actual information about it. An example would be in just the text I read that the bride is asking that her king come and take her to his chamber, to his bedroom. Now, we don't need to assume from that he's a literal king. It's possible that he is, but he is her king in any case. She sees him as a king, as a glorious royal figure, and that can be irrespective of whether he ruled any kingdom or not. There are other times when the camera, the scene, will seem to switch from a rustic setting, a Bedouin's tent or a rustic setting in which the two are together in that sort of place, and then they're transported immediately to a palace. And in one case there's a tent, and in the other case there's a palace, and it's hard to know how the change can have occurred so quickly, and we don't need to assume that anything actually really changed, except the perspective of the one giving an opinion. This rustic place is still rustic, but in my eyes it's a palace. Sort of like saying, I'm in heaven when I hold your hand. That kind of language is throughout here. And so there are dream sequences. We'll see it in this book as well, where the bride in both cases tells us that she's dreaming, and then we'll hear events that occur in her dream. So we can be prepared to find those things. Well, I said there are three propositions we want to consider, and let me start with the first one. Godly passion is honorable. It is a fair generalization that for most of history, faithful Christians and Jews have tried to resolve the tensions posed by human sexuality with stern warnings and denial. That's a fair assessment of history. But these attitudes have surely changed. Very few people in this church or churches like ours believe now or are taught that human sexuality is something shameful, something inherently sinful, something dark, something to be avoided, something to be denied, those things. The number of Christian books, tapes, websites, etc. on the gift of sexuality is beyond counting. Denial is no longer doctrine. But the message that sexual activity is inherently sinful has been internalized by many people. You may approve intellectually of husbands and wives delighting in one another, naked and unashamed, but find that your feelings, your inner life, your inner response to such experiences is still conflicted, is still difficult. There is reasons that are complex to you and your experience that make it difficult, not in your mind perhaps, but in your feelings and your emotional response to affirm the good gift of God. The chorus, I mentioned that there are three voices, the bride, the groom, and the chorus that inhabit this poem. The role of the chorus is interesting. It sometimes exists so that usually the bride can say a word and the chorus is sometimes named the daughters of Jerusalem. She'll say a word about what she's thinking and feeling. She'll ask them a question or they will ask her a question. The chorus exists to sort out at times the kind of speakers, usually the bride's feelings on things. But sometimes it exists as the voice of the author. And sometimes the voice of the author, more penetratingly, is the voice of God, telling us how we should understand events. And I think that's true in this case. It's true at the end of verse 4, in these words, "We rejoice and delight in you. We will praise your love more than wine. How right they are to adore you." That is God speaking of this husband and wife as they are gathered in one another's arms and heading into a place of making love. God's voice speaking his approval. We will hear that again. And if you are someone who finds some conflict around kind of your interior sense of the way God made you, I hope you'll let his voice speak. The voice of the Spirit of God is the most powerful healer there is. And what he says can change what we experience from the inside out. The second point to make, the second proposition, is that godly passion is powerful. Now that may seem like kind of a firm grasp of the obvious. I don't think anybody would say that the passion that kind of resides in our sexuality and all its potential is anything but powerful. We experience it as powerful. And there's certainly a physiological basis. There's a bodily basis for that. There's biology. The biology of reproduction is sort of a starting point that drives us toward what Ray Stedman used to call the urge to merge. Hormones and blood vessels and strategically placed nerve endings, all of these are kind of the starting point for some of the power that we experience in passion. But the real power to change us, to move us, to shape us, to alter us, the real power of godly passion comes from the promise of being known and loved. The delight of physical touching is linked to one's heart being touched, to becoming one in the profoundest sense. Two bodies making love are one body. But the biblical description of marriage as two becoming one is much more profound than that. It's entering the life, entwining your life around the life of another in every aspect, all of you with another person for a lifetime. And the power of that we're referring to is deepest and most discoverable in if we looked at the whole person, one merged with the other. I want to continue in verse 5 and listen to the bride speaking of a need for kind of inner healing listen to what she says. Verse 5. Dark I am, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me, and they made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I have neglected. Tell me, you whom I love, where you graze your flock and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? The chorus. If you do not know, most beautiful of women, follow the tracks of the sheep and graze your goats, your young goats, by the tents of the shepherds. Listen to some of what this young woman is saying about herself. She's saying to the other young women, the daughters of Jerusalem, don't look at me. I don't like the way I look. I've been burned by the sun. My life hasn't turned out the way it wants to, and I experienced that in my appearance. I don't want to be looked at like this. Now, if there is a message that will resonate with the world we live in, conflict over appearance, young people, especially probably women somewhat more than men, hating themselves because of their appearance, not wanting to be noticed as they are, not being able to believe the best about themselves by their appearance, is surely evident everywhere around us. And this bride is saying, don't look at me. And she harkens back to her brothers, her family that she was raised. I was treated with the anger of my brothers, and my life hasn't turned out the way I wanted to, and I don't like how I look, and I'm not thrilled with the family I was raised in and how that has shaped me in this respect. She's working hard to benefit others and has lost herself in the process. She's doing this work that she's assigned to do, and yet she is diminishing in her own eyes. She can say of herself, I'm dark and lovely. I know I'm worth something. But it's hard to see, and nobody much notices. And my own vineyard I have not kept. And she's kind of in a turmoil struggling with believing the best about herself, about concluding something good, that finding value in herself. Now we know, as those who know Christ, who love all of the message of the gospel, we know that everybody struggles with the same thing. With some discovering of yourself what is not valuable, but discovering in yourself brokenness and need and failure and all. And we know that the only voice that can speak to that is the voice of God. That ultimately it is the Lord who sees beauty where no one else can see it. It is the Lord who fixes what's broken. It is His voice that remakes us, married or not, woman or man, young or old, in whatever condition we're in, it is God's voice that will speak. But it is also true that He made us so that those of us to whom He gives marriage have one person in our life who can speak His voice in a way that no one else can. It is God's voice that will heal us. But if you're married, there's a person in your life whom you've given permission to come near. And if that person will speak to you the truth of who you are, will affirm what God knows to be true about you, will say it in a way that can change you. You have the opportunity, if you're married, you have the opportunity, if you're husband and wife, to serve the Lord by speaking great truths into the experience of the one you're married to, of the one you love. You can be His servant in that person's life in a way that no one else can. And that's what this young woman cries out for. She's looking for you whom I love. Make yourself known to me. She's in some despair over her life experiences, and she's looking for her beloved, the one she loves, to say something else to her about herself. We can say to the one with whom we are making a life together, I choose you without reservation. It doesn't matter what anybody else says about you. It doesn't matter how you feel in the presence of the other folks. It doesn't matter what your brothers and family and past has done to you. It doesn't matter what the world, the harder world of hard knocks that you're in has, how that has shaped you. It doesn't matter. I choose you above all others with all my heart for all my life. We have a chance to affirm the person in a way that no one else can. That's why unfaithfulness is so devastating. To break the opportunity we have to be a blessing to someone, because there are others that we've chosen. There are others who are rivals. There's the unique opportunity to say you're different than everybody else to me is broken, is unmade in when unfaithfulness occurs. I think it's helpful just in this same vein to advocate the importance of anniversaries. The importance of occasions when you remember what the promise you made the first time, you make them again. When we look for chances to say who you are to me, you, only you to me. And we look for occasions to be able to say it again and affirm it again and rebuild it again. That's what's occurring in this setting. A woman who is in some crisis about herself and a man who has the opportunity to make a difference to her. We continue on in verse 9, and here, instead of the woman beginning by herself looking for the man she loves, we find the two of them in conversation. The call earlier was that the bride began this book by asking for her husband to come near to her, and now we find them near to one another, and there's going to be kind of a growing crescendo. They'll each speak. There's back and forth. There's a dialogue, and it becomes more intimate, and they're nearer to one another. They're approving more. It's sort of growing in intensity. What she asked for earlier is happening now. Verse 9. I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your necks with strings of pearls. We will make you earrings of gold studded with silver. The bride. While the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. My lover is to me a sachet of myrrh resting all night between my breasts. My lover is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. The groom. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful your eyes are doves. The bride. How handsome you are, my lover. Oh, how charming. And our bed is verdant, and the beams of our house are cedars. Our rafters are firs. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. Now, there are a number of things happening in these speeches that I think if we listen carefully, we can detect. Clearly, they're talking to one another. They are physically nearer to one another, and they're growing nearer to each other. In a moment, we're going to see them lying in bed together. That nearness is being gained by them physically. But they're also speaking of other things. They're saying what they mean, what each of them means to one another. There is a combination here of tender speech, of single focus, of security provided. Each of them secure in the eyes and in the estimation of the other. They feel desire. They're choosing physical intimacy. And all of these reinforce one another. What you say, how you feel, what you do, what we remember, what we choose, touching, talking, silent articulation, faithfulness remembered, all of it plays together. And passion is powerful when all of us connects to all of another person, and we see that in these speeches and in the actions that certainly are taking place as the speeches occur. Occasionally, people will say of their marriage, how come things aren't what they used to be? How come we never talk anymore? How come we never touch anymore? How come we never laugh together anymore, or something? And the sort of the immature response is, you know, how come we never laugh together anymore? Well, let's go buy a book of jokes. You know, that'll solve the problem. Of course it doesn't solve the problem. Because the reason we don't laugh together anymore is because we don't talk together anymore, and is because we're not attentive to one another anymore, is the reason we don't talk to one another anymore. And the reason we're not attentive is because we don't touch one another anymore. And the reason we don't touch one another anymore is because we don't believe the best about each other. And the whole thing is a circle. And everything about us together reinforces every other thing. And that's what's taking place in the lives of these folks. And all of it will grow or will diminish together. Do I care about you in every way, and do you know it? And if so, something beautiful happens. And if not, everything begins to fade. And the reason we don't laugh together anymore is because so many other things are missing. And can we begin moving forward, starting somewhere, making choices, bringing renewal, small steps, seeing God work, expecting the best? Verse 2 of chapter 2. Like a lily among thorns is my darling among the maidens, the bride. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. He's taken me to the banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. Strengthen me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am faint with love. His left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles, by the doves of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it's time or until it so desires. The call that I began in the first verses reading this morning is that the husband would come and take the bride to himself. We find by verse 6 of chapter 2 that has been accomplished. The images of them lying together in the same bed with his left arm around her and his right arm around her, and they're holding one another as lovers. The thing she had called out for has now become the case. And then, stepping back for a moment, sometime later, there's a word to the daughters of Jerusalem, to the chorus. Then the bride speaks a lesson. She says this: don't awaken love until it's time, till the right person in the right setting to allow every good thing that God intends in a relationship to exist. Don't begin the process. Don't play with fire. Don't start events in play that you'll have a hard time stopping once they're started, until you're ready to have the relationship be as it ought to be. Now, this warning is going to be spoken three times. It's one of the big ideas, one of the important lessons of the book, is as glorious as the good thing is, it is also, because it's so powerful, it needs to have the context God made for it. And so these warnings are repeated, and we're not going to take much time on this now. In fact, not anymore. But I do want to come back to the point when we read the same advice given again later in the book. There is one last thing, though, I want to say, and I mentioned early on that one of the points of information or insight given us here is that godly passion is intoxicating. Godly passion is honorable, it's powerful, but it's also intoxicating. And to make this point, I want to ask you just to sort of use your abilities as observers. There aren't real concrete applications to make here. This is more about seeing things, I think. There aren't action steps to take, but there is a perspective to gain. And I want to ask you to just listen to some observations and ask God to make them clear to you. There are a number of references to wine in this text. In the opening verses, the bride speaks of the love of her man being greater than wine, and the chorus, which I think represents, in that case at least, the voice of God, also uses the same language. God's approval also uses the language of intoxication. And then in chapter 2, the phrase, he's taken me to his banqueting hall. That's actually literally the house of wine in Hebrew. And once again, we're introducing the idea as they grow nearer to one another. In every respect, there's this kind of intoxication that takes place. They're being swept away. They're caught in something that's bigger than themselves, that kind of no one can completely control anymore. There's some loss of being in charge that takes place. Intoxication creates unpredictability. We don't know exactly how things are going to turn out. You lose control of choices and outcomes. Now, why these references? There are more of them later in the book as well. Why is this important? What is it teaching? Is it just poetry? Does it have something more to say? And I want to just make some observations. One of them that surprised me is this. The old commentators on this book, many of them were nervous about talking about husbands and wives having sex. So they would allegorize the story. They would say, well, this is really about Yahweh and Israel. This is really about worship. This is really about Christ and the church. This has spiritual application. It's not about anything else. But what's interesting about those commentators, those teachers, those older style teachers, is that they focus most of their attention on the most sensuous passages, on the passages that talk most about being swept away, about being overcome, about being ravished, about being intoxicated, that they believe the holiest and most worshipful stuff was this very stuff that suggests intoxication, that suggests loss of control. And they were saying that when God is most fully present, I think they were saying this, when God is most fully present, we are least in charge. We are connected to something that no longer responds to our commands, but we are taken, swept up in Him, into His presence, seeing what we could never see otherwise, being placed on a path that is not of our choosing, a life changed utterly by that which is not ours to control. It is the image of intoxication that is most about the ways of God for them. I prefer my religion to be predictable, to be honest. I like a deal where God makes promises, I have responsibilities, I accomplish my responsibilities, and He gives me blessings. That's the deal we make. He takes initiative, I respond, I get something for it. And I know what it is ahead of time. And there's little deals on timing. You know, timing can be off a little bit here and there, but it's mostly pretty predictable. But Aslan, of course, is not a tame lion. And God's ways are not our ways. And He's more dangerous than that, and He is more wild than that, and He is more wonderful than that. And if we deal with Him as He is, we will find ourselves going to Kashmir for reasons that make no sense to anyone else, or stopping to care for folks, or giving up what's ours, or denying ourselves, or living as if this world isn't our home and we're going somewhere else and someone else is in charge and it's dangerous. The sentence in Ephesians 5:18 about drunkenness is interesting. So many of you will remember having read it. It says, "Do not get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. Instead, be filled with the Spirit." Now, notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say, "Do not get drunk with wine, but always stay in control of things yourself." It doesn't say that. It said the thing that might lead you to get drunk with love or drunk with wine or drunk with anything else should be that instinct in you to make those choices should be turned toward the Spirit of God Himself, who will take control and give and make your life a surprise to you and a wonder to you as well. Most of us at one time or another have been fools for love. Paul uses that language in 1 Corinthians and says, you know what? At a deeper level, we are fools for Christ. We're caught in something we can't explain. Someone else is driving the car, and we're going places we couldn't have predicted otherwise, or else we're not dealing with God as He really is. A few months before Leslie and I were engaged, I was well into realizing that I was in love with her. And I was a senior in college, and she was traveling in Europe with a friend. And I realized I gained an inordinate fascination for our mailman during that that time period. Now, this is a long time ago, before when you actually had to wait for letters to show up. You know, it's this very weird, old-fashioned thing where they would come by mail and nothing instant took place. But I was really into mailmen. I every day I'd come home, you know, I knew when the mailman was supposed to show up. I was tapping my foot. I was looking down the block. I was hanging out by the mailbox. I was fascinated with mailmen. And letters didn't come all the time. And they came unpredictably. And I wasn't, most days I couldn't be sure if a letter was going to come or not. And then it would come and I would read it and I'd read it again. And I was being a fool. There was nothing rational about the way I was acting. The letter was going to be there later, whether I was there when the mailman showed up or not. There was no point in my paying attention to their routes and their time and all that stuff. Foolish. It was foolish behavior. But it was being foolish for love's sake. And what you learn, I think, about being a fool for love may be a doorway to being a fool for Christ. That his call is something that is more remarkable and wonderful, but less about our control and less about our ability to explain and more about mystery than we can know. There are many in generations, Sophia's age or so, that are tired of generations like mine having answers to everything, Christian. Being able to explain rationally why it's smarter to be a Christian than not. Whether that's that impatience is a good thing or not, there is probably something to, an only good thing or not, there's certainly something to learn from folks that are saying there's mystery in this. And God is bigger than all the boxes we've built for him. I had a lyric from a hymn stick in my mind without me wanting it to. I don't know the song. I don't know the tune. I don't know what the rest of the lyrics of the song are. But somehow, some way or other, I heard a lyric that is in a song. It's actually, I looked it up now. It's a song by Annie Johnson Flint that was written in 1941. But the lyric has stuck with me because of its power to make my knees grow weak at times and to make me realize that I'm dealing with something that I can't be in charge of. And it might be more wonderful than I could describe if I were a genius. And I never memorized it, but I can't forget it, and I'm going to read you the lyric and we'll be done. Simple. May not mean much to you, but somehow or other, this has always sort of taken my breath away. His love has no limit. His grace has no measure. His power, no boundary, known unto man. But out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again. Amen.